Well, thanks for the introduction, ladies, and we're going to have a little bit of a change of accents now. And actually, there's going to be a trifecta of Australian. So hopefully by the end of the talk, we'll be accustomed to the accent. I will try and slow down my speech, because Australians tend to speak very quickly. So thanks to the organisers for inviting me here, and I'm going to be talking today about a project that we did on some commercial ranches in California. But to Megan's comments about filling out your evaluation form, I just would like you to do that because actually California is going to be the location of next year's meeting as it relates to this topic. And so I hope that anyone that's interested will come and visit. We're going to be doing some unusual activities like attending a optional tour of a water buffalo AI centre. And I don't know if you've ever worked with these beasts, but they're not the friendliest beasts on earth, so I'm kind of interested to see how they synchronise them and get them bred. But we do have the program scheduled for August in 2015. So I'd like to talk today about this project, and I just will mention for those of you that are interested, the paper outlining what I'm going to detail today is published and it's open access available at Journal of Animal Science for anyone that's interested. But if you want the summary version, that's what I'm going to give you here today. So basically, I'm going to talk about this project and what the objectives were. And basically, we were using DNA information, specifically parentage testing, to have a look at the prolificacy of commercial sires in a natural breeding situation on some large commercial ranches in Northern California, and have a look a little bit at the calving pattern of those sires and how you might use parentage testing to look at prolificacy of sires in a commercial ranch. So basically, this was a three-year-long project where we were basically working with three large ranches that had anywhere from 700 to 900 cows apiece. And we were basically genotyping all of the commercial bulls that went out with those cattle. There was about 2,100 mother cows per year that were involved in this project, and somewhere in the vicinity of 120 Angus bulls and 15 other breeds there. And we were taking DNA samples on all the progeny and following them through all the way to the slaughterhouse. And actually, we also collected a little meat sample from each animal at the slaughterhouse to make sure that we were still talking about the same animal as what we thought we had on the ranch, as what we had hanging on the hook, because there was actually a fair propensity for mix-ups at that stage of the process. And the overall discussion that's going to be today is having a look at the bull performance in these multiple sire breeding pastures. So basically what we did was we collected hair samples on all the calves that were born on these three ranches from natural multi-sire breeding pastures, which basically represented 15 calf crops because although there were only three ranches, two of the ranches had both fall and spring breeding seasons, as is fairly common in that area of the world. All of the samples were genotyped with SireSeq parentage panel, which is basically a 99 SNP panel. So you're doing 99 different loci are getting tested. And basically a sire was assigned to a calf if it was the only bull that had no what's called opposing homozygotes. And what I mean by that is if the bull, for example, is big A, big A, and you genotype a calf and it's little a, little a, then clearly that calf could not have come from that particular bull because it would have had to inherit a big A if it was going to be the father of that particular calf. And using that approach, we were able to single sire match 98% of the 5,000 odd samples that we genotyped for this project. So we had pretty good success, even though we had sometimes quite large numbers of bulls out with the cows using this technology. And I think it's, in our experience, was able to single sire identify a lot more calves than the older microsatellite based technology, which sometimes was a little bit more. Not quite able to differentiate maybe full brothers as to who was actually the sire of a particular calf. So we're standing here in Oklahoma, and I guess you're kind of envisioning what might a commercial ranch in California look like, and contrary to maybe what you're thinking, it's really not at all like this. I kind of like this 1949 picture of, this actually is a legitimate picture from California in 1949 of the Red Bluff Bull Sale. But actually, and you won't be surprised to know that the ranchers look pretty much like the guys that are sitting in this room, and gals too. This is Jack Cowley, who is our biggest ranch. He has about 900 to 1,000 cows, and Dan Drake there is one of my collaborators on this. He's a cooperative extension field agent in California, and he had both a fall and a spring calving season. The Cook Ranch is run by three brothers, also have a fall and a spring breeding season, and they have about 10 bulls going out per season. And then the biggest group we had was Moore Richardson Farms, who have about 30 bulls going out, and that particular ranch just has a fall breeding season going out with about 700 cows. And all of these producers belong to the Harris Ranch Alliance, Producer Alliance, where there's a partnership between the processor, Harris Ranch, and these producers to use a certain type of bull with regards to its genetic merit, and then they have some sharing of the increased value associated with those carcasses with the producers enrolled in this project. And so our other partner in this was Harris Ranch, who allowed us to come in to basically sample a piece of meat from each of the carcasses that were derived from these three ranches, which always took place at 4 a.m. on a Monday morning. I wouldn't recommend this project to anyone else because that's quite a big ask. I think we were there 25 different 4 a.m.s on a Monday morning to collect samples, but we found that was worthwhile to really keep our data tight in terms of making sure that carcasses were the same as the animals we thought they were, and we used DNA testing to confirm that. So in order to identify all the animals, we were using electronic EID ear tags to keep the individual uniquely identified, because otherwise, invariably, we had, you know, 7 number 13s and 27 number 18s, and it got very confusing. And so the EID just allowed us to keep every single animal uniquely identified. We did tail hairs for the DNA as our sample collection, and kept it all together in a computer. And when the university rocks up to help. With sampling, you can guarantee we slowed the guys down a little bit, especially the first few times. And really, I have to give a lot of credit and respect to the cooperating ranchers. I think they were happy to participate and thrilled to finish the project. And so we had the usual problems that you have kind of beta testing technologies. We had some bulls that were less than cooperative in certain aspects, and sometimes we had some tails that came in a less than pristine state. But we got through it all, and really I think some of our learnings was that, trying to get the EID wand to talk to the computer through a Bluetooth and those types of technology problems were constant, and we were always kind of trying to fix that, but as we got better at it and obtained experience, they became less of a problem. But each additional piece of equipment we added to our project kind of exponentially increased our problems. And we really needed a pretty high level of understanding of computers in terms of what port is connected to what wand and things in order to get the thing to work. And so it definitely wasn't a plug-and-play project. And the electronics were pretty durable, but we were really needed backup record keeping in the form of paperwork to make sure we got all the data. And I think some of this technology needs to be worked in the field a little more before it gets released to industry, because there are quite a few bugs left in some of these approaches. So then with that background, then the bottom take-home of this entire talk is probably summarized in this next slide, and it basically is the number of calves that were produced on each of the different ranches for the 15 different breeding seasons that we were looking at. And basically what you see here is this is the first ranch, A, that's the Cowley Ranch, this is the Cook Ranch, this is the Moore Richardson Ranch. And as you go across there, you can see the year, what breeding season we're talking about, the number of sires that were evaluated for that breeding season, the mean age of the bulls on that particular breeding season, the total number of calves that we were able to identify single sire parents for, the minimum number of calves that a bull had, and in this particular table we've eliminated those that had zero, although there were about 4 to 5% in any given breeding season that had zero calves. They had all been breeding soundness evaluated before the beginning of the breeding season. And then you can see the maximum number of calves going all the way up to 64 in the case of one particularly studly bull in the Mole Richardson ranch there. But what was really interesting was that the mean number of calves across all of those seasons and ranches was remarkably consistent. It was round about 20. If you break it down and you just look at the entire data set here with all the ranches, all the years, all the calves, the average number of calves any particular bull had was 19. And that number was very consistent. And so if we look at the number of progeny that commercial bulls produced on all the different ranches, we saw a pattern where some bulls were performing above expectations and some bulls were performing considerably below expectations. And so if you've purchased a particularly good bull, you certainly hope he's on this end of the scale. But as we'll see, the genetic merit for some of the traits we might be interested in wasn't necessarily associated with the prolificacy of the bull. And so although he might have looked really good on paper, if he only had one offspring, he wasn't really helping the genetic legacy of the ranch too much. So the number of calves per bull, the kind of breakdown on that was about 4.4% of the bulls in any given breeding season had no offspring for whatever reason. So they appeared to be sound going out with the cows. They had their breeding soundness examination, but they had no offspring. The mean was about 19, with relatively little variation between the ranches. And likewise, the average per season was pretty constant, similarly between years and between whether we were talking fall or spring. And so I think that 19 to 20 number per commercial bull is probably a pretty good number, at least for the conditions in Northern California. But what was really dramatic was that the mean number of calves per bull varied so widely, ranging from a mean of 3.3. This is for bulls that had more than one breeding season where they were being evaluated, up to about 40 on average. And the cumulative 205-day weight, or if you want to think about it, all of the weight produced by an individual bull by adding up all of the different calves that he produced was dramatically different between the bulls. So which bull then was producing the most gross income to the ranch? Was it the one that had the best genetics for weaning weight or yearling weight? Was it the sire of the heaviest calves? Or was it the most prolific sire? And let's have a look at that. So this graph I'll explain because it has a lot of information on it. Basically, the blue bars here are how many offspring a particular calf had, and that goes up against the left hand. So this particular bull had almost 40, and this particular bull had 3 or 4. The black line here is basically the mean weight of the calves of that particular bull. And so you can see this particular bull had really heavy 205-day weights. On average, his calves were quite heavy, which would be good, except that he didn't have very many calves. And so this red line is basically showing the total weight of calves that those particular animals produced. And what you see is these bulls that had kind of mediocre average weights in terms of 205-day weaning weights, it doesn't really matter they weren't stellar in that regard. The fact that they had so many offspring means that they had by far the most total weight produced, just because prolificacy was such a huge driver of total weight produced. And so the most prolific bulls by far were bringing back the most income to the ranch. And if you make some economic assumptions about how much money they're bringing back to the ranch, this is the same kind of graph here. These are the 40 bulls that are producing 40 or so offspring. And this is the mean feeder weight of the average of the calves being produced for each of these bulls. So this particular bull, again, had quite a valuable mean fetal weight average on his offspring, but because he had so few, he really didn't bring back much total value to the ranch, so he was bringing in the vicinity of $5,000 back to the ranch, whereas these guys producing 40 or so calves are bringing $45,000 in gross value back to the ranch. And so it just really emphasizes the importance of prolificacy as it relates to value coming back to the ranch. We found there was some relationship between bull age, so here's age across the x-axis, and the mean number of calves per calf crop. It's kind of curvy linear if you do a regression line through it, although there's a lot of scatter in here, but 5 years was about the peak prolificacy, and then it kind of falls off after that. But there are some older bulls that still do well, and there are some younger bulls that do well, but on average that's true. Is there anything we can do from a genetic perspective to try to select for bulls that are more prolific? And so we had a look at whether any of the EPDs were associated with higher prolificacy, and we were mostly Angus-based bulls, and so we had a look at all of the EPDs that were available on these young sires, so mostly not very accurate EPDs, just what you would typically get on a yearling sire. And the only one that we really found that had any significant association with prolificacy was scrotal circumference EPD. And I guess that makes intuitive sense. And that is, the higher the scrotal circumference EPD, there tended to be an increased prolificacy. There were outliers to this, and this particular bull on ranch number three, he was just a stellar performer in all 3 years, and despite the fact that his scrotal circumference EPD was not particularly high, so the average for Angus is around about 0.5. And if we do the regression line here, you can see there's a slight positive slope. If we include all of the ranches in there, all 1, 2, and 3, we get a slope kind of like this. But we have to take out that bull. If we include that very kind of outlier bull where he's got a very small scrotal circumference EPD and very high number of prolificacies, then this correlation kind of has a hard time even getting to be significant. But there is a slight trend, especially if we just look at regression on ranches A and B, and the reason we kind of had a look at that is their data collection was maybe a little tighter than ranch C, and so I think that is real, but it's only explaining about 12% of the variation in prolificacy. So there's a significant trend, but it's not explaining a lot of the variation in prolificacy, but it's at least something to think about when you're making selection decisions, because there did appear to be a significant correlation there. The next thing we looked at was the number of calves born per week of the calving season, and we defined the calving season as the day that the fifth calf of the breeding of that particular calving season was born, was day one. And you can see a very distinct peak here at week three of the breeding season, and it was actually significantly different from week two and four, and then it kind of falls down after that. And we split up the animals that were contributing to that into three different groups, and that is, we looked at the very prolific bulls up here that were producing more than 28 or so, then the kind of intermediary ones, and then the very low prolific ones, and had a look at how that broke down over weeks of the calving season. And what you see here is that the very prolific bulls, is the high prolificacy bulls, they're the ones that had 28 or more, have a very big contribution to that peak at week three. In other words, they're kind of disproportionately siring those calves that are born early in the calving season or the breeding season, and so that means that these, as has been discussed at this meeting, that the earlier you can get the calves born, that the more time they have to get to maturity of their replacement heifers, it's more likely that those heifers are going to be selected to be replacement heifers, because they'll be typically heavier because they were born earlier. And so you kind of have an indirect selection on the offspring of those very prolific bulls, because they tend to produce not only more animals but more early animals, which are most likely to be replacement heifers, which is a happy coincidence or fortunate, because that means you're actually selecting for highly prolific bulls when you're selecting these animals that are derived from those particular bulls. So we assayed every single calf that came through the entire experiment, which was over 5,000, and it's about $15 per parentage test, and that could get run up into some fair amount of money. And so we were interested in seeing whether we could get some sort of an estimate on whether a bull was prolific or not by doing some type of subset of animals. So what subset could we sample to get a representative sampling of the prolificacy of the bulls? And so what we did in that regard was we had a look if we just sampled, for example, only the calves that were born in week 3 of the breeding or of the calving season, would that give us a representative sample of which bulls were prolific, which bulls were not prolific, and save us the money of having to do parentage testing on bulls, all the calves born in weeks 1, 2, and the weeks subsequent to week 3. And so basically when we did that, we found that if we took just the calves that were born in week 3 and we assayed the number of calves they had, we were able to correctly assign highly prolific bulls to the highly prolific bull category, with the exception of 1% of the bulls where we reassessed them to be low prolificacy. So what we would like here is for this black bar, where we've assessed them to be very prolific or not very prolific, when in fact they are highly prolific, we'd like that black bar to be zero. But what we're seeing here is a very small number, 1% that got incorrectly assigned, and a slightly higher proportion that got assigned to be medium prolificacy. But you can see that if you take week 2, you have a higher proportion that are incorrectly assigned to be low prolificacy. Similarly with week 4 and week 5, if you put 2, 3, and 4 and you assayed all of those calves, then you don't assign any of the animals incorrectly as regards to highly prolific. So this is a very accurate way to do it, but of course then you're sampling all the calves born in 2, 3, and 4 weeks, which is getting to be quite a large proportion of your calves, and it will get increasingly more expensive. Similarly, if you just sample the calves born in weeks 3, 4, and 5, you won't get any incorrect errors of high prolificacy going to low prolificacy, but you have sampled that many more calves. So I guess the take home here is that you get a pretty good estimation of which bulls are prolific and highly prolific, and on the next slide, lowly prolific, if you just do a sampling of the calves that were born in week 3. And so that offers you a less expensive alternative to sampling all the calves that are born throughout the entire season if you just want to get a kind of a snapshot of where the bulls are with regards to their prolificacy. And so I just put that in there as a little practical option for people if they want to not have to sample the entire calf crop. So in summary, the bulls produced on average 19 to 20 calves per crop. The prolificacy varied anywhere from 0 to 64 calves per season. No single factor completely predicted bull prolificacy. They tended to increase as they got to 5 years of age and then declined. And bulls with larger scrotal circumference EPDs tended to be more prolific, but it certainly didn't explain all of the prolificacy differences. The bull contribution to total ranch income was highly, highly correlated to their prolificacy, and much less so to the average weaning weight of their particular calves. And the young bulls, if they were prolific in their first breeding season, they tended to be prolific in subsequent breeding seasons. It didn't explain a lot of the variation again, but it gave you a sense that if in that first breeding season, if they did well, they tended to do well in following breeding seasons. And if you just test those week 3 calves, it does offer a less costly alternative to prolific assessments based on the entire calf crop. So just what are the practical implications of that? So Dan Drake, my colleague, had kind of run some numbers, given that if on average you're getting 20 calves per natural service sire, and if you're holding on to that natural service sire for 4 years, which is kind of typical in our region, and you assume kind of an average bull death loss of 15%, and the bull cost at $4,500, I'm not sure if that's high or low for you guys, but it's not out of bounds for our area, you can kind of come up with a cost per live calf born of around about $92 to house and buy and have that commercial sire out there producing calves. And so that is an estimate of what it costs to produce a live calf from commercial sires. And I think that it maybe at this juncture, with some of the technologies being discussed at this meeting, it might be time to re-examine the relative cost benefits of using commercial sires versus some of the synchronization protocols and time breeding, which might provide an opportunity to access superior genetics and be at a similar breakpoint as what it is to actually use commercial ranch bulls. So to be cost-effective, you know, the parentage information has to be useful. If you're going to spend $15 per animal, it better provide you at least $15 worth of value in return. Otherwise, why do it? And so, you know, what are you going to use the parentage testing information for? You might be to confirm parentage, which might have some value to you. It might be to remove low prolificacy bulls, although the feasibility of that approach is dependent on you having some other bulls to take the place of those low prolificacy bulls. It also has implications, as I mentioned, for the genetic composition of the herd. The highly prolific bulls siring a higher number of the early born calves are likely to be disproportionately represented in the replacement heifer pool. The best genetic bulls weren't necessarily the ones that were the most prolific, and so you may have particularly good genetic bulls who only produce two offspring and have very little genetic impact on your herd. And, you know, I think the implication of this study, given on average you're getting 19 calves per bull, is it might be time to kind of reevaluate the economics of using elite genetics available via artificial insemination versus the exclusive use of natural service bulls, which tends to be what happens in many commercial ranches out west, I guess. So with that, I will just diverge for 1 minute to a totally different topic, if you will let me do so. So I have just presented to you some information about genetics and sires, and I think you probably think that probably what I told you was true, and you're not necessarily doubting that I'm up here sprouting misinformation. And I just want to draw attention to your fact that recently we published a paper entitled The Prevalence of and Impacts of Genetically Engineered Foodstuffs on Livestock Populations, and I have the abstract up here for anyone that's interested. This is a particularly controversial topic in the media and with certain groups, and it's interesting, when I talk on this topic, I'm instantly questioned as to my scientific integrity, and I kind of like this little meme that came out the other day suggesting that that particular paper was maybe associated with the toilet roll there, and there's quite a bit of kind of scientific slander going on as a result of publishing this particular paper, and I think it's just really important to talk about the fact that when we're talking about scientific facts, sometimes certain groups tend to exaggerate and attack scientists for putting out, in this particular case, a review paper. And I'd just like to encourage everyone to really look at these types of attacks with a skeptical eye and remind you of the fact that don't believe everything you read on the internet just because there's a picture with a quote next to it, and that was said by Abraham Lincoln. So I'd be happy to talk to anyone about that paper, but I will just say that I'm just as credible on the sire stuff as I am on the GE stuff, but it's kind of interesting how talking on one topic you're instantly suggested to be uncredible, and so it's an interesting political world that we live in. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.